From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a new investigative report that might affect the agenda at the Middle East Peace Conference. We talk with Seymour Hersh about his expose of Israel's secret nuclear arsenal and America's policy of publicly pretending it doesn't exist. Also today, a talk with Sonny Chirac. He was the first free jazz guitarist. Now his following extends into heavy metal. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Bad, Paul Fussell's critique of Americans' taste for the pretentious, overwrought, and fraudulent, and the banal, stupid, and sub-adult. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. 2 decades of conflict in Cambodia, including a 13-year civil war, were ended on paper today with the signing of a peace treaty in Paris. The treaty was signed by the warring Cambodian factions, the UN, and foreign ministers from 18 countries. Lynn Terry has more from Paris.
Almost all of the foreign ministers here said they hope the treaty will bring peace and stability to Southeast Asia. The UN, in what's expected to be its biggest peacekeeping mission ever, will have vast powers during a transitional period leading up to free elections. The UN will be responsible for demobilizing Cambodia's armies, monitoring a ceasefire, and organizing elections. UN officials will share power with the Supreme National Council, a 12-member group made up of all the Cambodian factions, including the Khmer Rouge. During their rule in the late 1970s, as many as 2 million Cambodians died. U.S. Secretary of State James Baker said they were no ordinary oppressors. In the name of revolution, he said, they used violence in a way that has few parallels in history. He said the new government should try former Khmer Rouge leaders for genocide. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The White House announced today that it has received formal acceptances to all its invitations to next week's Middle East Peace Conference in Madrid. The deadline for replies passed an hour ago, and it appeared for a short time that Syria and Lebanon might not have responded. The administration now says that Israel, its Arab neighbors, and the Palestinians have all officially said that they will participate. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said today that he'll lead his country's delegation to the talks. In a surprise move, Clarence Thomas was sworn in as the Supreme Court's 106th Justice today in a private ceremony. NPR's Pas Cohen reports.
The ceremony was so private that the Supreme Court's Public Information Office learned Thomas had become the 106th Supreme Court Justice only about a half hour after the fact. According to court spokesperson Tony House, the judicial oath was administered to Thomas by Chief Justice William Rehnquist at 12:05 p.m. in his conference room. Thomas's wife, Virginia, held the Bible for her husband. The only other people in attendance were Thomas's main Senate backer, Republican John Danforth, and Justice Rehnquist's administrative assistant. Today's swearing-in had been scheduled for November 1st. House said a courtroom ceremony will still be conducted that day as a formality. House said Thomas had asked to move the date up so his staff could be put on the Supreme Court payroll as of today. The court is on a 2-week recess. I'm Pas Cohen in Washington.
Stock prices showed little change today after a session of mixed trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about a point to finish the day at 3,040.9. Declines led advances by a slight margin in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 185 million shares. This is NPR News. Soviet psychiatrists acknowledged today that their profession was used to assist in the Communist Party's repression of dissidents. The Soviet newspaper Izvestia carried a formal apology from a panel of scientists and psychiatrists who found that a well-known dissident was unjustly diagnosed as insane because of his views. The investigation was conducted into the case of Peter Grigorenko, a decorated Red Army general who was kept in mental hospitals intermittently during the 1960s and 70s. The Izvestia report said that this may be the first case of an official admission of the past abuse of Soviet psychiatry. Croatian radio says the historic port of Dubrovnik has come under heavy shelling from the country's Serbian-led Federal Army and Navy. Pierre Vickery reports that eyewitnesses in Dubrovnik are claiming that mortars have caused considerable damage to medieval buildings and shops.
According to a journalist in Dubrovnik, mortars and other missiles began falling inside the medieval city walls in mid-afternoon, with one explosion causing considerable damage to shops on the city's main street, Stradun. Belgrade Radio confirmed the bombardment, warning that a decisive battle for the city was imminent. Croatian television said that fierce fighting was in progress on the outskirts of Dubrovnik, involving tanks and heavy artillery, and that hotels holding hundreds of refugees from other parts of Croatia had come under attack from federal warships. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The White House said today that President Bush may approve more loan guarantees to help the Soviet Union buy American grain. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the president is considering the move to help ease the Soviets' expected food shortage this winter. Fitzwater said that the president may also send technical experts to the Soviet Union to help improve the country's inefficient food distribution system. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the countries of the Middle East prepare for a peace conference, one of America's most esteemed investigative journalists has completed an exposé of Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. My guest is Seymour Hersh, author of the new book, The Samson Option, Israel's Nuclear Arsenal and American Foreign Policy. Hersh describes this book as a study of how Israel became a nuclear power in secret, and how that secret was shared, sanctioned, and at times willfully ignored by the top political and military officials of the U.S. since the Eisenhower years. Seymour Hersh is a former New York Times reporter who is currently on special assignment with the paper. It was Hersh who broke the stories of the My Lai massacre, how the CIA spied on American citizens, and Noriega's connection to drug trafficking. Hersh is the author of books about Henry Kissinger and the shooting down of the Korean airliner that strayed over Soviet territory. He told me he wrote his new book because everyone knows Israel has nuclear weapons, yet the White House has never wanted to talk about it. Well, why not?
Well, what are you going to do? You're the president of the United States. You're running for re-election, let's say. Let's say you're Jimmy Carter in 79. And there's evidence, as I write about in my book, that the Israelis and the South Africans secretly conducted at least one, and I think I write there were three, tests of low-yield neutron devices in the South Atlantic. And you record it, and your intelligence community records it. What are you going to do? You've just had Camp David. You've just signed a peace agreement between, nurtured a peace agreement between Sadat of Egypt and Begin of Menachem Begin of Israel. You've been shown up in Afghanistan to have misjudged the Soviets, who apparently are tougher than you initially gave them credit for. Your policy of human rights, your wonderful policy, basically, instinctively, that is, of trying to push human rights around the world, has sort of backfired in your face. You want to be reelected. You've got a problem going in Iran in terms of hostages and all sorts of upheavals there. Are you really going to take on the Israelis over nuclear weapons in right before an election, and have all that heat from Congress and what frankly is a pretty considerable lobby, the Jewish lobby? You're not going to. You're just going to look the other way. In every case, there's always a reason for the American president to have other priorities, and he does.
Why did Israel assume it was in its best interest to keep the arsenal a secret?
Oh, I think they're going to drop that now, by the way. I think my book's going to flush them out a little bit, and the peace conference is going to have to flush them out. I think in the beginning there was a genuine fear. Don't forget, the Israel of the 40s and 50s was a socialist country, Ben-Gurion, a Zionist country, who had tremendous support from Jews in the diaspora, and particularly from American Jews who were liberal by nature, more anti-bomb, anti-war. And I think, particularly given the left-leaning of the country and of Israel in the 40s and 50s, the kibbutz notion, collective living, all those socialism, I think there was a terrific fear in the early days that if they talked publicly about what they wanted to do, they would lose their means of support. There was no indigenous economy or money base in the first years, and there still isn't very much. They depend totally on external aid, privately from Jewish groups and publicly from the United States.
If you're just joining us, my guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, and his new book, The Samson Option, is about the secret nuclear weapons program of Israel.
Now, and let me say, an American foreign policy, because it's also about what the Americans did with it. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You say that President Kennedy got permission for an American inspector to examine the nuclear plant once each year, but the Israelis built a false control room and other fake sites to fool America. How do they do that? How do they get away with it?
Well, first of all, it's the use of simulators, simulated training facilities, is common in pilot training. We all know, we've seen movies or news television accounts of how pilots are trained in simulated cockpits. Similarly, when we train technicians for a nuclear power plant, they are generally trained in the same sort of a facility, simulated. It's all simulation. So the idea of using a simulated control room wasn't that novel. It just took a lot of guts to get away with it. What they did is underground, they built a control room that gave every appearance of being the control room for a peaceful scientific research plant, as they claimed Dimona was. And when Kennedy insisted and basically demanded in a very nasty exchange of letters with Ben-Gurion, and Kennedy really did believe in nonproliferation. He absolutely was committed to it, as no president was after him. And Kennedy finally persuaded the Israelis that they must let an inspection team in there, or they were going to lose any chance of getting American aid, including military aid, as the 60s went along. Well, they just faked us out. They just built a simulated control room. Our team, it was more than one man. It was a team of especially selected men from our nuclear facilities in Oak Ridge and elsewhere, including, I'm sure, some intelligence people. In fact, I know some intelligence CIA people. And they went in and saw the fake control room, and bought it.
What can you tell us about how you found out about this fake control room?
Well, actually, in the book, I quote the head of the Americans under Kennedy and Johnson. There were about 10 inspections between 1961 and 1969 when they finally were stopped. And they all were led by the same man, a man named Floyd Culler, who was one of the ranking experts in making of a bomb, of the plutonium for a bomb from Oak Ridge. And Culler led the teams, and Culler talked to me. Eventually, I ended up quoting Culler, particularly when I told him there had been a fake plant, and he wasn't astonished. He understood that his inspections, as he said to me, and I quote him as saying, were just sort of the gilding of the lily, that if they really wanted to stop, Americans really were interested in stopping it, they would just go ahead and stop it, stop support for the Israeli bomb program. How I found out about it, Israelis told me.
On the record, off the record?
Oh, no. God, you couldn't. I got a lot of Americans. I felt good about one thing. I got a lot of Americans, ex-CIA guys who retired. This was a narrative, and I started in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s. A lot of the old-timers eventually went on the record with me, agreed to let the name be used in my book for the first time. Eventually, because I got some of the older guys to go along, some of the newer guys went along, and eventually I got a lot of people on the record. The Israelis, no way. There's no way I did get one Israeli to talk to me, and that was sort of a rather famous defector from the Israeli intelligence community, a man named Ari Ben Menashe, who's been the subject of much debate in Washington currently, because he is publicly alleging, since he's been disaffected from the government a few years ago, he's publicly alleging that there was a 1980 October surprise. And a lot of people have rejected his views pretty abruptly in Washington.
Well, people in Washington and Israel have tried to discredit him. He used to work for Israeli intelligence, but Israel basically disowned him.
Well, I think it started with him first, but that's okay.
Okay. But you trust him?
Do I trust a man who spent 15 or so years in the Israeli intelligence community? No more than any prudent journalist would trust anybody. I will tell you this. I didn't want to see him initially. I was almost done with my book when I was persuaded by a former American CIA official that I'd be making a mistake if I didn't see him. I went and saw him wherever he was living, more or less, not on the lam, but basically in exile. He's not in Israel. And within 5 minutes, it was clear that this man was indeed inside. He knew so much about the bomb program that I'd already learned. Menashe was real. Ben Menashe was real about those things. He then told me some things that I found hard to credit, and I confirmed all of it. And he's a most interesting man.
And let me get to the most controversial thing that he told you that you go with in the book, and that is that Jonathan Pollard, the Israeli spy who was in the United States, gave Israel United States intelligence on Soviet targets and Soviet air defenses. And then Israel used that information to aim nuclear missiles at the Soviet Union.
And then, at the express direction of Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who's still Prime Minister, that information was retyped, sanitized, I guess the technical word is, and passed along to the Soviets.
It's like the ultimate double deal, you know. You're using information to target your missiles at the Soviet Union, then you pass on the information to the Soviet Union to get on their good side.
I think the Israelis would just call it very, you know, sort of realpolitik and prudent. The fact is that Israel has always targeted the Soviets. That was one of the main theses of developing its nuclear program. The Israelis, don't forget we're talking about men who came from Eastern Europe. They know about the Holocaust. And their goal was never, never again, that wonderful phrase, that they wanted an independent deterrent because they just never thought that in case they would be overrun again, that anybody would help them. Harold Brown, the Secretary of Defense in the Carter years, and a very wise man about such issues, once said to me that he said in essence, I'm abbreviating a little bit what he said, that we had a chance in the early 60s, the only real chance we had to stop Israel from going nuclear was in the early 1960s, when we could have offered them the nuclear umbrella. And he said there were only two problems with that. That is, in other words, we could have told Israel, don't develop nuclear weapons because we will defend you in case of a nuclear crisis with the Soviets or somebody else. Our missiles will come to your aid. And as Brown said, there were two problems with that. One is that the Israelis would not have believed us. And two, we would have been lying. It's a very complicated issue. And Israel's determination was that just as nobody in the West reached out to protect the 6 million Jews, despite all sorts of notification and warnings, we had other fish to fry in that war. Nobody would reach out to protect them. And the Israelis just decided no Arab country would ever attack them with the intent of overrunning them without Soviet aid. And if Israel could let the Soviets know as soon as they were technically proficient, which was in the late 60s and early 70s, that any such attempt would lead to a bomb on Baku in southern Russia, Tbilisi, the oil fields, a one-way F-4 plane to Moscow, something, well, that's a deterrent. And anyway, the point is Israel needed to target the Soviet Union, the kind of intelligence they did not have indigenously, which is satellite intelligence. And that's what Pollard was all about, getting the kind of intelligence they needed to target the Soviet Union.
So let me see if I have this straight. Israel targets the Soviet Union to deter the Soviets from backing an Arab war against Israel. At the same time, Israel passes on secret American intelligence to the Soviets to get on the Soviets' good side so it's not totally reliant on the United States, kind of playing one superpower against the other. But how does Israel manage to let the Soviets know that they are being targeted by Israeli nuclear weapons and at the same time claim to not have a nuclear arsenal?
They tell them privately, and the Soviets go for it, of course. The Soviets aren't interested in advertising the fact that they're being sort of strong-armed by the Israelis. One senior official told me a couple years ago, we're going to make nice to the Israelis. It's a great issue for them with Israel being so having so much weaponry in that part of the world. They'd like to defuse the situation. There's nothing as incongruous as you make it sound. It was a pretty shrewd thing by Shamir. It was really pretty shrewd to try and improve relations which have improved enormously over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. We're discussing the subject of his new book, The Samson Option, Israel's Nuclear Arsenal and American Foreign Policy. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Seymour Hersh is my guest. What would you say Israel's nuclear strategy is now?
Oh, I think they're sort of confused now. You know, I should also add that one of their targets, of course, their basic targets are the Arab capitals, you know, along with the Soviets. I think they're ready to start. I'd like to think they're ready to be more realistic and start talking more openly about their weapons, and also more willing to begin de-escalating. And I think, you know, my book was just published a couple of days ago, and you're going to see the Arab world has not been heard of yet, and we've got a peace conference coming. We're going to see, I think, this issue being put on the table. Or if it's not going to be put on the table, it's not going to be put on the table because of an awful lot of backdoor bargaining about it. I think the Israelis are willing to start maybe even open up their arsenal to international inspection of some kind and to start getting rid of some of the warheads they don't need. After all, they did, as I said earlier, begin their whole program with the idea of aiming at the Soviets. And by the way, I must tell you that one of the things that shook Israel to the core was in the late 60s, after the 67 war, in which they had sort of beat the brains out of everybody in the Middle East, if you remember that famous Six-Day War. They learned that the Soviet Union had added four Israeli cities to its target list. Our intelligence community told the Israelis that they were now a target, a nuclear target. I think that was a factor in their decision also to target the Russians in return. It's a mm-hmm. real tough game out there.
Yeah. Now, your book was really kept a big secret. I'll say we certainly had no idea it was coming out this week. And I think it wasn't listed in your publisher's catalog.
Right.
And the first notice I saw about the book was a story in the Sunday New York Times, you know, this past Sunday. The same day that Israel decided to commit to going to the peace conference. Is there any, is it coincidence that your book is being timed at the same time as the peace conference?
What do you think? Do you think we can maneuver that?
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, books can be rushed out.
Oh, it was rushed out. I was still writing this book, and I was finishing up checking and double-checking in July. But, you know, there's absolutely no. Look, Louis Brandeis, the famous Supreme Court justice, once said, sunshine is the best disinfectant. And I'm not at all going to be persuaded by anybody that my publishing the book now is going to be deleterious to the peace process. It's not. I think it's going to be good for the peace process. I think we can get the issue out. I also think it's very important for the people of Israel to have some idea what's going on in the name of their leadership. You know, even though I think, and I have no illusions, people in Israel, I think, by and large, support the idea of Israel being a nuclear power. But I don't think they realize how nuclear it is, how easy it's going to be to use nuclear weapons in the next war there, how every Air Force base, or most bases, many bases, I should say, and the long-range artillery units have nuclear weapons standardized and ready for use in the stockpile, how they're nuclear landmines along the Golan Heights. They're not armed, but they could be very easily. The holes are dug. And, I you know, it's not. I'm not suggesting Israel's a superpower. It's not. But it's a tough little regional power. And I think the people ought to have some say in the Israeli government.
You said that you think that your book might be good for the peace talks. How would more information about Israel's secret nuclear arsenal be good for the peace talks?
I'll take you in good faith that you're asking that question, you know, just because that's your job. I mean, how could it not be? Is the world really better off if there are 3, 4, 5, 1,000 nuclear warheads in Israel ready to go without any public discussion of it? Will the Arabs be willing to settle for any sort of a peace agreement without this issue getting on the table? This issue has to get on the table. It is a basic core security issue of that area. The fact that Israel is nuclear and they're not has to be discussed, and you can't avoid it.
Now, a point that you are strongly making in your book is that Israel's nuclear weapons need to be made public. They need to be discussed openly by countries around the world. Do you oppose Israel having nuclear weapons?
If I'd been a kid and if I'd been a Shimon Peres, who was so active in this as a 29-year-old kid, a young man working for David Ben-Gurion in Paris in the 50s, I'm convinced I would have thought having a nuclear weapon would be essential, that we would never again be in a position to have a Holocaust. And I can really understand the reasoning of that, and I make no moral judgment about what they're doing. I think it's different. The book's called The Samson Option because, you know, the biblical story about Samson destroying the temple rather than go down himself. And how could you fault that morally? This is a country that had gone, you know, the people had gone through so much, there was so much fear and distrust. And Israel was never able to differentiate between Hitler and Nasser and Brezhnev and Khrushchev. They saw them all as all one continuum. The Holocaust mentality, it's known, as Golda Meir was particularly vulnerable to it. But now you have not just a doomsday bomb, but you have the weapons have become standardized for use by every military unit in case of war, and that's a different kettle of fish. And that's not what the Samson option was. That's an extension of it that I think has potential dangers and needs to be discussed. Look, at the minimum, we have to put it on the agenda. We cannot pretend in America and the rest of the world that it doesn't exist. We're talking about something that exists that everybody is in a conspiracy to pretend doesn't, and that's wrong. And that is also short-sighted.
You end your book by saying, basically, that if there's another war in the Middle East, there's a good chance it would be nuclear, that the unthinkable would now be thinkable. What has changed that would make another war in the Middle East a nuclear possibility?
Well, just what I've been saying. Instead of having a few bombs at control of the prime minister and he has to authorize it, as in 73, and it's a big deal, you now have Air Force planes and on runways with nuclear bombs attached to them, ready to go on alert. You now have bunkers full of warheads under Tel Nof is one big Air Force base in Israel where they have an awful lot of weapons stored. As I say, the American Intelligence Committee has seen photographs of that. You now have nuclear artillery shells that can be thrown into a long-range cannon. And I think we basically have to begin the process of extricating our head from the sand, from 31 years of sand or 35 years of sand that we've been buried on top of us.
You have objected to how the American government has consistently turned its head and looked the other way when it came to Israel's secret nuclear weapon program. What is it particularly that bothers you about that?
Come on, you got to be kidding. My government has explicit detailed information on Israel being a major nuclear power at the same time that every year Congress is certifying, based on statements from State Department officials in charge of proliferation, that Israel has never tested a weapon and therefore should be allowed to have foreign aid. What bothers me is my government has been living a lie, and that's wrong. And look, here I am. It's Hirsch living in Plato's Republic again, or being Pollyanna. But this is pretty egregious. This is a question that gets to the core of what kind of world we want for our children. It's been avoiding dealing with the Israeli bomb for 30 years because of more expedient reasons. Political pressure, the perceived lobby, worry about what the Arab world would do, in reaction. The notion, the canard that everybody had, that a lot of American officials told me in the beginning, well, it's really good that we don't go public about it because then we don't rub the Arabs, and I know, whatever the cliche, what do you do, rub their nose in their bombs and the dirt, and therefore the Arabs don't do anything silly. I mean, give me a break. The Arabs have known all about the bombs for years and are desperately trying to do it. They're just not as competent yet, but they will be. You can't forestall the inevitable. Unless we deal with this now, we're going to have 12 countries in that part of the world, in 15 years looking for nuclear, going nuclear.
Well, you're off to London. Let me let you go. Seymour Hersh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Seymour Hersh's new book is called The Samson Option, Israel's Nuclear Arsenal and American Foreign Policy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sonny Chirac was the first free jazz guitarist, but he thinks of himself as a horn player. His following now extends into the worlds of jazz and heavy metal. Coming up, we talk with Chirac and listen to excerpts of his new records. Also, bad books, bad cities, bad films, bad food, bad hotels, bad ideas, and bad people. That's bad with a capital B-A-D. Maureen Corrigan reviews Bad, Paul Fussell's new satirical critique of American popular culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Foreign ministers from Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and Jordan are meeting in Damascus with representatives of the PLO. The meeting is part of the planning for next week's Middle Eastern Peace Conference in Spain. Tim Llewellyn of the BBC has more on the story.
This meeting in Damascus is a victory for the PLO. It makes it clear to everyone that the PLO effectively will control the Palestinian elements at next week's peace talks. And the Israelis have had to swallow this. In Arab terms, the PLO is now back in the main regional frame after its unhappy experience backing Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War. The meeting itself will certify bounds beyond which the various Arab delegations will not go in any negotiations. The Arabs know full well that they will have to make concessions, but at least they know that the Israelis also have conceded. By turning up to a conference that is predicated on the concept of exchanging land for peace, and facing Palestinians across the table, who may not be of the PLO, but are definitely with the PLO.
Tim Llewellyn of the BBC. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir will head his country's delegation to the Middle Eastern Peace Conference. A spokesman says that Israel is officially accepting the U.S. and Soviet invitation to the meeting, which begins next week in Madrid. This announcement appeared to indicate that Israel has accepted the Palestinian delegation to the talks. 14 people from the West Bank and Gaza were named yesterday to be part of a joint Palestinian-Jordanian delegation to the conference. On Capitol Hill, Carter administration budget director Bert Lance testified today before a Senate subcommittee investigating the scandal-ridden Bank of Credit and Commerce International. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Lance said he was introduced to Agha Abedi, the Pakistani founder of BCCI, shortly after he resigned as budget director in 1977. Abedi found a buyer for the National Bank of Georgia. Lance was president and chief executive officer of the bank, a buyer the Federal Reserve Board says was a front for BCCI itself. Working as a consultant for BCCI, Lance said he in turn found a Washington, D.C. bank for Abedi. It later became known as First American Bank, and he introduced Abedi to Washington power broker Clark Clifford, who later became chairman of First American. Clifford, a former Secretary of Defense and advisor to Democratic presidents, claims he was unaware that First American was also illegally controlled by BCCI. He's scheduled to testify before the Senate subcommittee tomorrow. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
In Oakland, California, officials now say the death toll from a deadly weekend fire has gone up to 23. 18 people are still listed as missing. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 1 point to close at 3,040.92. This is NPR News. Former hostage Jesse Turner met his 4-year-old daughter for the first time today. Turner was reunited with his family for the first time in nearly 5 years at the U.S. Air Force Hospital in Wiesbaden, Germany. Turner's wife said father and daughter shed no tears, but that there were plenty of smiles. She also said that her husband was weak, but otherwise appeared to be in good condition. In South Africa, at least 9 people were killed and dozens injured as armed men rampaged through a train carrying workers into Soweto from Johannesburg. It was the latest in a series of train massacres that have cost at least 65 commuters their lives since political fighting began last year. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports from Johannesburg.
Survivors today described a scene of pure horror, hundreds of commuters jumping off moving trains trying to escape an armed gang of men who hacked and shot dozens more. After the attack, say witnesses, bodies, some in pieces, lay strewn along the railway tracks, and survivors stood by, bleeding profusely. Police believe the attacks were in retaliation for the murder early this morning in Soweto of a Zulu man in his car. His passengers fled to a nearby Zulu hostel. Soon shots rang out, say police, and the attacks began on trains nearest the hostel. Today, the ANC and the Inkatha Freedom Party blamed each other for this new round of bloodshed. The ANC called for stronger defense units in the townships. From Johannesburg, I'm Renee Montaigne.
The Federal Reserve says a new survey of business conditions around the country finds a U.S. economy that is weak or growing slowly. The central bank says in most areas there has been little improvement in retail sales. Officials found either a slight move upwards from the recession or, in some cases, setbacks after a brief spurt of activity in late spring and early summer. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. During the free jazz movement of the 1960s, saxophonists left behind melody and chord changes for the unstructured abandon of shrieking, squawking solos. My guest, Sonny Chirac, was the first free jazz guitarist, using volume and electronic distortion to get the feeling saxophonists got from overblowing. He was first noticed on the 1967 Pharoah Sanders album Tahid. He's since recorded with Herbie Mann, Wayne Shorter, Don Cherry, and Miles Davis. But now Chirac is also part of the art rock scene. In the New York Times, he was recently described as the gray eminence of Manhattan's downtown avant-garde. His power playing has won him a new heavy metal following, but his new records, Ask the Ages and High Life, also show his melodic side. Pharoah Sanders is featured on Ask the Ages. From that album, this is a Chirac original called Promises Kept. Described yourself as a guitarist who always thought he was a horn player. Why did you play guitar instead of saxophone?
Oh, I had asthma as a child, and that plus the expense of a saxophone. When I started playing, the guys I wanted to play with, they had a guitar around, so they said, well, play this. And I picked it up and tried to play it.
Now, what did you want the guitar to do that you heard the saxophone do?
Sound like Coltrane. That's what I wanted. That sound that the saxophone players, well, not just saxophone players, like Miles, too, that what used to be called the cry of jazz, that's what I was after. And I'd never heard that done on a guitar. And that's what I wanted to reach.
When you were first starting, what were your early attempts to get that cry?
Oh, boy. When I first started, I was having so much trouble just trying to keep up, trying to, you know, learn changes and scales and keep the time, that I wasn't working on it. It was just in my head. But then after a couple of years, I developed some techniques that I thought would lead me to, you know, reaching that cry. One was a very fast trill, like Albert Eiler did on his saxophone. That's what I tried to do on the guitar, to create a very fast trill that way I could control the crescendo, decrescendo of the notes, you know, because guitar at that point, back before the electronics had taken such a hold in guitar in 1960, 61, that was the only way to really sustain a note.
By trilling it?
Yes, right.
This is the pre-Jimi Hendrix days.
Yeah, right.
So as you got more advanced, well, let's move up to the present. What do you do now to get the kind of distortion that you sometimes want to have?
I just turn the amp up and play. I don't use any kind of effects anymore. And I just, it's in the hands by now, or else you don't play at all, you know. That's my feeling.
Let me play your solo on Promises Kept. Can you tell us a little bit what you're doing on this?
I don't know, because it was a one-time thing. I think we recorded it in one take, and which is the way I like to record, so I don't remember at all what I did. I just played what I felt.
So you don't have any gizmos or anything attached to your guitar?
Nothing at all. I do on stage. I use a wireless system because it gives me mobility and I can get around the stage. I like being all over the stage, but that's the only thing I use besides the volume knob. That's
And how do you work the volume?
Well, I use a Marshall amplifier, which is kind of strange for a so-called jazz player, but I turn it up to really usually no more than about 4 out of 10. I turn it up to a 4, and turn the guitar all the way up, the volume knob, and just play. I really believe your sound is in your hands. I've always believed that. Like horn players believe that their sound is in theirs.
Most free bands didn't have guitarists. Was it hard for you to find a place for yourself?
I was lucky because I met Farrell Sanders early on in my time in New York, and I was working with him quite steadily. Now, by that, I mean we were working down at Slugs for $8 a night most of the time, but we were, working and we were playing around. And then I joined Herbie Mann like my second year in New York. So I, went on the road with him for almost 7 years. So I was pretty fortunate in that I, always had a chance to play. A lot of guys didn't. I was just lucky, I guess.
How do you think your playing has changed since then?
I think that I've, as I've grown older, and maybe as you should when you grow older, I've gotten rid of a lot of the things that I didn't need, and I'm down to the essentials now, or very close to it. I'm closer to the melodies that I want to play and much surer of the rhythms that I want to use.
We know, in talking about melody, perhaps the most familiar melody on your recent records is your version of All My Trials. And something I was very surprised to hear.
Everyone's surprised at that.
Yeah. Well, it's an old folk song.
Yeah. That's been a tradition, though, with jazz players, I think. For a very long time, to take old melodies and that they may have heard as children, or things from folk music or spirituals, and to play them in a jazz manner.
Let's hear Sonny Chirac's All My Trials from his album High Life. Ever into learning Charlie Christian or Wes Montgomery riffs?
No, and I admire those guys, but I'm just not very fond of the guitar. The standard approach to learning how to play jazz is to listen to your favorite player and copy their licks and then develop your own out of that. And I was starting at 20 years old, and I realized I didn't have time to go through that very long route. I figured that would take 10 years to work yourself out of that, to find yourself. So I just started right out playing what I heard in my head. And at that time, it was very little. But, that's the way I did it. I never played anyone's licks. I think I do know one Coltrane lick that he was very fond of playing on ballads. And sometimes I do that just for fun. But I never played anyone else's riffs, no.
You say you're still not fond of the guitar?
No, I don't like it. It's not as human as the horns.
Because there's no breath in it?
Maybe that's what it is. I guess that's what it is. But it just doesn't have the same. Even piano players get a more human feeling from their instruments. You know, you take someone like a monk who just, you know, that every time you hear, monk could play one note and you would know it was him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they get such a good feeling from the instrument. But guitar, and especially jazz guitar, when I started playing back in the early 60s, it all sounded exactly the same. The other night I heard a guitar player, and I realized that when a guitar player plays chords, and you'll see these guys with these magnificent hands, and they play chords that go 10 frets and things, you know, all these crazy things they do, and it all sounds like it could fit on a postage stamp. Guitar is exactly the same from the top of the guitar to the bottom of the guitar, you know, when you do it like that. And that's why I'm not so crazy about it. It just doesn't have the scope of other instruments, you know.
Is this to say that if you could, you would change your instrument tomorrow?
No, I don't have to because I'm already a tenor player. Lots of guys laugh. I mean, Farrell Sanders always cracks up when I tell him that, but it's true. I never have looked at myself as a guitarist.
But you are, you know.
No, I'm not.
You still have asthma?
Well, when my wife asks me to do certain things, yeah. You know, like, if you know, women have a thing about painting, you know. They like to paint apartments and things, and I hate that. And whenever she gets into, maybe we should paint, the asthma thing will jump up then, you know.
But you could blow if you wanted to now.
No, I don't think I could. I don't think I could. And I'm 51 years old now. It's too late to start that.
Guitarist Sonny Chirac is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Guitarist Sonny Chirac is my guest. So tell me what you think some of the advantages and disadvantages have been of, like, bypassing the standard way of learning jazz, you know, learning other people's riffs off of records and, you know, coming up through bands when you're in your teens and things like that, the things that you miss because you started when you were 20.
Yeah, I think the main advantage is that you're already on target when you start. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I knew how I wanted to do it, and I wasn't able to yet, because you still have to develop technique.
How did you deal with the frustration of being 20 and hearing something in your head but not having the technique to get it?
Well, I had no choice. I remember when I was in seventh grade, my teacher said to me, she said, you're a very bright young man, and I don't want to see you end up working in a factory. And she scared me to death with that because I had not a clue as to what I wanted to do at that time. But that's what's always driven me, is that I knew there was something special inside me. Not that I'm so special, but there were some special things inside me. And I wanted to get to those things. And I didn't want to, you know, end up someplace where I couldn't use those things.
Do you think if it hadn't been for music, you would have ended up in a factory?
Oh, I would have been dead by now, I'm absolutely sure.
Of what?
Probably whatever young men die of in the street. I was the typical urban teenager, you know, leader and warlord of the social gents, you know, the whole thing. I did that whole street thing. So I'm sure music saved me. And that when I started playing music, I stopped doing any kind of drugs and I, you know, got very much into the music. I remember once my mother, I was still living at home and working very hard on the music. And I was taking lessons, composition lessons from this guy, and I was at the piano in my room once, and I'd been at it for a few hours, and my mother, I felt someone watch me. I looked, my mother standing in the doorway, and she said to me, you know, you need a girlfriend. You know, right then I realized that maybe I was going at it a little too hard.
You are now involved with, you know, people in the art rock scene and the Manhattan's downtown experimentalists. Were there years when it was hard for you to find your place, you know, in the years after the free jazz of the 60s, in the years between then and now?
I was someone in Europe called those lost years. I was working around New York at different places, Verna Gillis's Soundscapes and places like that. I was working in Europe at least two or three times a year. I just wasn't recording, so that kind of takes you out of the picture. But I was working, and mainly I was working on the music that I'm playing now. I was writing it and developing the style that I'm playing in, so I was, you know, spending a lot of time on the guitar, just developing my music.
It's hard to make a living when you're staying at home composing, though.
Yes, it is. So you end up doing a lot of things that you don't want to do, like chauffeuring what else was I doing? I was working in schools with disturbed children and things like that.
Doing music with the children?
Sometimes doing boxing with the children, whatever it took to get, you know, to control them a lot of times. I mean, you know, it was a pretty rough time for me, but everybody has rough times, I think.
What kind of chauffeuring were you doing?
I was driving for this real estate guy, you know, all over the city to different appointments that he had.
In one of the scenes that you're involved with now, you're kind of a senior member, because, so, you know, a lot of the people are a lot, not that you're particularly old, you're, what, 51 or something?
51, right.
Yeah, but a lot of the other people are more in their 20s or 30s, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make you feel older than you are?
No.
The older member?
The guys in my band call themselves Sonny's Kids, you know. But I don't even think about age. I'm just so happy to be playing good that I don't care. It doesn't matter. You know, I've got a long way to go. I've just discovered myself, you know. It's just now starting to happen for me musically. I now am able to play the things that I hear.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you. I want to thank you very much.
Oh, it's been nice talking to you.
Sonny Chirac's new albums are High Life on Enemy Records and Ask the Ages on the Axiom label. Chirac is on a national tour that will take him to Cleveland, San Francisco, Oakland, and North Hollywood, California in November. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. There's a report on today's announcement that the U.S. will begin the process of normalizing relations with Vietnam. Also, government and industry's reaction to yesterday's report that the ozone layer is in worse shape than we thought. There's yet another attempt to get New York Governor Mario Cuomo to run for president. Two members of Congress are launching a draft Cuomo campaign. And the aftermath of the fire in Oakland, California. It looks like that fire may turn out to be the most expensive blaze in U.S. history. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You have to have a lot of bravado to entitle a book bad. It's too easy for reviewers to turn that title against you. But Paul Fussell enjoys stirring up and studying a good fight. Fussell teaches literature at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's probably best known for his book The Great War and Modern Memory, which won the National Book Award in 1976. Maureen Corrigan says that it's probably smart of Fussell to have arranged his sabbatical leave in London to coincide with the publication of Bad.
It seems that all the really wicked social satirists these days are reactionaries. Kingsley Amis, Miss Manners, P.J. O'Rourke. Comic crankiness lately has gone hand in hand with conservatism. Maybe it's because there's so much free-floating resentment around caused by the challenges to the old guard. Besieged conservatives who are merely resentful sound sour. But lots of conservatives manage to be resentful and funny. Then they sound like H.L. Mencken, the elitist Mencken, who once remarked that you'll never go broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people. Paul Fussell does a mean Mencken imitation in his new book, Bad, subtitled The Dumbing of America. That subtitle lets you know that Fussell is continuing the rant against the bourgeoisie that he began in his earlier book, Class. In Bad, Fussell foams at the mouth via 33 short essays that contemplate cultural decline. He denounces events like the proletarianization of air travel after World War II, the invasion of the giant pepper mill in elegant restaurants, and the introduction of fine Corinthian fake leather into our luxury automobiles. His snooty longing for the glory of bygone days can get pretty insufferable, but Fussell redeems himself through his droll, nasty, and absolutely on-target criticisms about awful aspects of life in the United States. Fussell distinguishes bad, capital B-A-D, from just plain bad this way. Just plain bad is something like a case of scarlet fever, something no one ever said was good. Fussell's bad is different. It's something phony, clumsy, witless, untalented, vacant, or boring that many Americans can be persuaded is genuine, graceful, bright, or fascinating. Bad examples are the Statue of Liberty, Atlantic City, girls named Kimberly, blockbuster novels like that recently exhumed classic, The Exorcist, and any musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Because of his academic background, Fussell hocks up his bitterest bile and aims it at bad colleges and universities. Some are vanity schools like Nova University in Florida that hand out PhDs in exchange for life experience and lots of cash. But Fussell also rips into state universities that he says create students who automatically join the labor force without the capacity to wonder about what they're doing. There are plenty of other pithy, clever tirades in Bad, all alphabetically arranged for easy reference. Bad architecture, bad hotels, bad naval missile firing, and bad people. My only complaint against Bad is the bad way it made me feel after reading it, smug, superior, and gilded with a fine coat of intellectual fraud. In some ways, what books like Bad offer to people is not all that different from those quickie degrees sold by places like Nova University. For about $19, you can take Paul Fussell's lively gut course in contemporary culture. You graduate with a Ph.D. in Fussell fussiness, equipped to make witty put-downs about anything middlebrow. Bad is a fine read if you just want to snort at all that's tacky and pretentious in America. But as a guide to how to really think hard thoughts about culture, it's a bad education.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Our technical director, Joyce Lieberman, is having a baby, her second, so she's leaving us for 6 months. We'll miss her, but we can't wait to meet the new kid. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Gary Marshall directed Al Pacino and Michelle Pfeiffer in the new film Frankie and Johnny. He also directed the smash hit Pretty Woman. He created the sitcoms Happy Days and The Odd Couple, and his TV writing credits date back to the old Dick Van Dyke Show. Gary Marshall is my guest on the next Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.